Hello, and welcome to today's audio conference training on crafting visitation policies that account for battering, offered by the Office on Violence Against Women in partnership with Praxis International. My name is Beth McNamara, and I will be your host for today's call. So thank you to those of you who have joined us for the last two sessions, and also welcome to those who have just joined us. We have several people who have just registered for today's session, so thank you for joining us. And we are concluding our three-part series today. So we're going to go over a few details. I apologize to those of you who have joined us for the last two calls and have heard our housekeeping details, but I did want to let people know that we are recording today's call. We have had a lot of requests for people wanting to listen to these two parts and hopefully this part that will be taking place to listen to in the future. And we announced that we're recording it for that purpose to put up on our website. And I wanted to let you know that we've posted the first two recordings already, so you can go on our website and download those at your leisure. Along with the recording, you'll also have an attachment to get the materials as well, so that if you're forwarding it to other members in your community that didn't register, that you still have access to those materials. And we have materials for today posted on our website as well. I emailed them to you all a couple of days ago, and then they're also posted on our website just in case you didn't get them. So go on our website at www.praxisinternational.org, and you'll be able to find those. So we have a full agenda today. We have Jane Sadusky and Ellen Pence joining our call today for the third part of Fatal Flaws and Remedies in Writing Domestic Violence-Related Policies. Ellen is the Executive Director of Praxis International, and Jane is a consultant with Praxis and has done an incredible amount of work over the past 2 years they both have with the Supervised Visitation Grant Program. We have on our agenda, we're going to try and take an intentional break in about 40 minutes for questions, but that doesn't mean you can't put yourself in the question queue beforehand so that you get your question answered. So just push one, and then Stephanie, the operator, will be able to help you get your question answered. We have our lines muted so that everybody has an enhanced voice quality to the call so we can't hear background noise. But by pushing one, it will alert Stephanie to unmute your line when we can take questions. So please feel free to do that. And without further ado, I'm going to turn it over to Ellen to get us started.
Okay, thank you very much, Beth. One of the things that we always want to say is that this whole series is brought to you through the Technical Assistance Program from the Office on Violence Against Women. They pay for this, they approve the agenda, but they don't necessarily, you can't take everything that we say as gospel, that this is not OVW talking, this is Praxis talking, and sometimes especially in this whole area of policy making, you really have to make sure as you're working with your policies, if you're drafting new policies, that you're working with your program managers so that so that you're really making sure that you're being consistent with OVW guidelines, et cetera, in making your policies. So OVW approves us doing this, and they approve this agenda, but not everything we say. It's kind of mine and Jane's and Beth's opinion about how to go about this. So just keep that in mind, that we're not OVW people specifically. Also, we'd like to just say that the first time we kind of went through the kind of the 9 tips of policy making, they were pretty broad. We got a lot of feedback from that one that we had spent so much time on the first 3 and then rushed through the last 6 that they wanted us to be more paced. You did. So then the last one, we paced ourselves right through the agenda, which was the architecture of a good policy, which is really about writing them. And people said, okay, good, you paced yourselves right. But the feedback we're mostly getting is that this is all really good information, it's overwhelming, and the people want desperately, could you give us some model policies that we could look at? Could you give us some sample policies? And, we're talking before these meetings and after them that, that's something that should be available to you. There are no sample policies or model policies that are put out yet. I do think that we're moving in that direction of having at least sample policies in 3 or 4 or 5 areas so that a pattern get set about what a policy following all these rules would look like. So for those of you who are totally frustrated that that's not available to you, we are giving the message to OVW that people are really needing not necessarily every policy written, but a number of policies that really adhere to all these rules that we're giving you or all of these hints or tips so that people can get a pattern going in how to write them. So we appreciate people saying that. We are conveying that to OVW that it's something that you all really want. So today what we're going to talk about is some of the fatal flaws in writing domestic policy. Someone also wrote that they really want us to spend a little bit more time on, and what about domestic violence? And so we've got what we're looking at as a checklist of how, when you're writing any kind of domestic violence policy, whether it's for the criminal justice system or supervised visitation centers, how you think about domestic violence in policy writing. So we're going to go through a checklist on that today. So Jane, Mo Sheeran, who was with us in the last two calls, can't be here today, and she sends her regrets and enjoyed doing the first two. And she'll be listening to this last one to see what you all missed out because she wasn't here. But Jane and I will go through today's, and we're just going to go through several kind of flaws in policymaking. And if you get out we just sent out a few little sample policies, and we didn't send these out as sample of good policies. We just sent them out as samples of policies so that we could kind of make note of some of the flaws we're talking about. We found flaws in every one of these policies that match our what we call the fatal flaws of policymaking. And then when I was reading these things, I was saying to Jane, oh, I found a few more fatal flaws that aren't on our list of five, and we'll go through a couple of those too. So we're going to start out with the first flaw of policymaking is when your policy just lumps everything together as domestic violence and doesn't recognize that domestic violence isn't all the same thing. And Jane's going to start us out with that one.
Okay. Thanks, Ellen, and thanks to everyone who's listening in on the call today. The fatal flaw one is not distinguishing among different types and levels of domestic violence. I think this is one of the biggest discussion that's swirling out there, as we've realized that over the last 30 years or so of all of the attention and reform work around domestic violence, we've kind of ended up lumping everything into that one big bucket and labeling it domestic violence, when what we lose sight of then is that these distinctions between battering, the coercive control, that ongoing pattern of intimidation and coercion and threats, which I think is a lot of what we all carry around in our heads when we say domestic violence, we're really talking about battering with that specific intent to control and dominate a partner that's carried out through this combination of ongoing physical, sexual, emotional attacks and has this aspect of coercion to it. So that gets thrown in the bucket. Then the reaction to that gets thrown in the bucket. So if I'm trying to stand up for myself, if I'm trying to defend myself, retaliate for what's been done to me by a battering partner, protect someone, my children, another family member, resist and push back against that coercion, well, that all gets thrown into the big bucket too. And then everything else that's not related to battering and that kind of resistance to battering gets thrown in there. Those situations, for example, where a brain injury or trauma can produce a change in behavior and violence against a partner or their family members. So we've kind of thrown everything into the big bucket. And that means then that we lose sight of that principle that's guiding our work under the visitation program, which is equal regard for safety of children and adult victims. So that throwing everything in there then is not very helpful in really aiming our response to build that protection and safety for adult victims and their children. So looking at our sample policies, for example, if you look on page 2 and line 50, the center was first and foremost designed to provide safety to adult and child survivors of domestic violence, stalking, sexual assault, and child abuse. It's using the language that's been used in the visitation program, but it's also kind of throwing everything in there. And part of our responsibility then in writing our policy and avoiding these fatal flaws is to really be clear about the wide range of violence that's included in that term domestic violence, and in particular to distinguish among battering, resistive violence, non-battering violence, realizing that just that is a big discussion, and it relates back to, if we think of what we were talking about, those 9 tips and the architecture of a good policy, it relates back to being really clear about how we're defining our mission and our role in this intervention. So part of the remedy then is defining terms, being clear about what we mean when we say domestic violence and making that distinction between...
I was just going to say, too, you get a lot of women who are visiting, right, in the visitation centers who use some violence and they've lost custody of their kids.
Right.
A combination of maybe she got arrested one night and then he got a protection order and now she's out of the house and she's visiting the kids in the center, but he's the one that's been battering her. So that would be kind of a typical, I think, in some centers, as many as 40% of women are visiting their children in the center, and most of those women are battered women.
Right, and if you're not taking time to make that distinction and understand what you're meaning, you're going to miss that in being able to craft policies that account for that and account for that safety. So I think one factor in this is whenever you start being really absolute to and say will, always, must. It's not that you would never say that in a policy, but that's where you can kind of get backed into a bit of a corner. I think it was last time we were talking about policies that set these very strict, arriving, departing, 15 minutes, and shaping things around the time that someone's there rather than around a policy with a purpose of preventing parents from having contact with each other, which is related to that understanding of domestic violence and taking time to articulate things and ask questions from that point of view.
Can I throw something in here, Jane, about work with the Jane and I are working on a project in St. Paul where we're trying to get all of the players together to write their policies simultaneously. We're writing policies for 11 different agencies right now at the same time. And in there, we're trying to say to the visitation center doesn't have the capacity to completely determine, is this a battering case, is this resistive violence, or is this something totally different, because they don't get much information when they get the case. They don't get the police report. They don't get enough to really make that determination, so they talk to her and they talk to him, and that's really all they have. And sometimes they don't even really get anything in writing from the court that brings people there. They might get a protection order affidavit, but there's a wide range of what visitation centers do and don't get. And one of the things that Jane and I have been doing in what would be the equivalent of your collaborative, we're bringing the agencies together to say people cannot intervene in these cases unless we all share what we know about these cases in a way that makes us all effective. So part of your policy, Jane's talking about in writing your policy, it would be great if you could tell the difference between a batterer, someone who's reacting to battering, and someone who's using domestic violence, but neither one of those things is going on. The only way that's going to happen is if your collaborative is set up to let you know some of that. So this would be, for some of you, an impossible task if all you get is a referral and two people show up your door and they're telling you stories. You know, you can maybe intuit what's going on, but you can't really, I mean, none of us can totally know any of these, but you, the way that you would really know is if you had access to information. I'm just writing the policy for the probation department, and I'm trying to write into that probation policy that visitation centers should have access to the top half of a pre-sentence investigation. So if a person is on probation and using a visitation center, the center should have access to that pre-sentence investigation, which has the whole history of violence written in it. And trying to make available to people who are intervening in these cases, batterers, treatment people, visitation centers, others, this criminal court information that's very important in letting us know who is doing what to whom and with what impact. So this is maybe a little bit of a discussion for another time, but it's important for us to think of how are we using this collaborative to let us figure out which type of violence are we dealing with at our center. And this is kind of the new talk in the domestic violence field, is this whole issue of differentiation. To effectively intervene, whether in the criminal system, family court, juvenile court, visitation centers, treatment programs for batterers, you have to be able to at least break it down into these three categories. And so it's kind of the wave that's around there, but the capacity to do it is still limited because people aren't automatically, by how it is that they intervene, gathering information so we can break it down that way. Would you say that's right, Jane, that we're not quite where we need to be in terms of giving visitation centers the information they need?
Right. That, and also kind of taking all of these points of discussion and thinking of them as kind of the warp and the weft. If we're collectively weaving this fabric of safety, there's a lot of things that go into that. And you're right, not expecting that visitation centers have the information they need or can go it alone.
One thing that will be available in this summer is this thing called this Blueprint in St. Paul. And it is it's a criminal justice set of policies that all fit together, but it's a good thing to bring to your collaborative because it shows the way policies can all weave together and can make these distinctions, because every policy, from the dispatcher to the police officer to the investigator to the PSI writer or probation officer, all of them have to make this distinction of what kind of violence are we dealing with. And then the other thing that's coming out is the National Council on Juvenile and Family Court Judges and the Battered Women's Justice Project is working on a project where they're doing this differentiation for family court. So, and that's even more tied into what visitation centers do. And they are going to use these three categories Jane gave you as a way of distinguishing in family court, that what they're trying to create is an off-ramp. When people go into family court, if there's any domestic violence, it goes onto this off-ramp, then an assessment is done to distinguish between these three forms of violence and then how severe each form is in terms of where it's at and the level of violence, so that the family court, which is who you're mostly dealing with, would be doing this kind of assessment as a part of a routine assessment for how much where the kids are going to live and how much access they're going to have to the other parent.
And onward to FLAW 2.
Oh, are we? Onward to FLAW 2. Okay. All right. FLAW 2 is this one where policies use categories that lump dissimilar situations, people, or events into one group. And so I think this one is one that everybody knows about. When we use this term custodial parent and non-custodial parent, there's obviously half the people using your visitation center are custodial and the other half are non-custodial parents. So it's a natural divide. But once you divide people that way, you can't necessarily think that all the non-custodial parents are the ones that potentially cause harm to the other. And this is where the lumping together is a problem. It's not so bad that you make the division and lump people together. It's what you attribute then to that group of people. So visitation centers for a long time have said, okay, we're going to have the custodial parent, the ones that are attached with the children, and the non-custodial parent. So we're going to set it up, the assumption being that the non-custodial parent is the problem parent more, and that they're probably more dangerous. So we're going to have them come to the visitation center first and make sure that they can't hassle the non-custodial parent as they're coming into the center. So let's get them in here, get them seated, and then once they're here, the non-custodial parent can safely come in. Well, what happens when the custodial parent is, in fact, the dangerous one, the one that's doing harm and battering the non-custodial? Now you've got the custodial parent able to be outside the building or wherever to see, to know when this exactly what time this person is coming in, and to be there unsupervised. So the idea of separate entrances and staggered times was to prevent contact, but mostly it was to protect one parent from the other, and typically the custodial parent from the non-custodial. But as we know, in many centers, it can be up to 30, 35, even 40% of battered women are the non-custodial parents, and therefore the way we've set it up is to assume that they're the ones that need to be protected against instead of protected. So that's kind of the most obvious lumping together. I want to give a couple in your sample ones here now of lumping together dissimilar things. And what you want to basically say is every single time you use a category of any kind, ask, what have we brought together into this category and what assumptions are we making about it? So children that refuse to visit is a category in many of your policies. So let's go to, where is that now? Children refusing to visit is on page 1. And I want to go to line, in this sample policy we have, if a child or parent refuses to come to the center, that's one visit refusal. And then the second one is if they're already at the center and then they decide not to, that starts at line 21. So look there. If a child arrives at the center and is saying that he or she does not want to visit the non-custodial parent, we will. So now you've lumped together all of these children who don't want to visit, and you've said we're going to do four things with them, even though the reasons those kids don't want to visit can be really, really different. The condition, lots of things can be different about that, but you've said no matter what those differences are, this is what we're going to do. If age appropriate, we're going to take aside and speak to him or her in private. We're going to ask if they'd like to shorten the visit for 10 or 15 minutes. We're going to ask if they just want to say hello. We're going to ask if they would like to write a letter or draw a picture to the parent. So basically what these four items are doing is saying, is there some minimal contact we can create between the parent and the child? The child doesn't want to go in for this whole visit, so there's some minimal contact, and here's our four ways of getting that minimal contact. And maybe if they start one little thing, it'll allow the whole visit to happen. So maybe if they say, okay, I'll go in for 10 minutes, maybe the whole visit will happen. So these four things are presuming some universal kind of condition amongst these children that don't want to visit. So now let's stop and go back and say that there's a whole lot of reasons kids don't want to visit, right? They don't want to visit because they're scared. They don't want to visit because they're mad at the parent. They don't want to visit because they feel a loyalty to the other parent. They don't want to visit for many, many reasons. And would you say that these four things that you will do really cover those four reasons well? And if they don't, if you can imagine circumstances that these four things are not that useful to do, then you've got a problem with this policy. And I can imagine situations where these four things are not really the things you want to do if a child doesn't want to visit. And so you have a situation then where this policy is lumping together a group of dissimilar children as one group and then having four things you're going to do regardless of why those kids are in that group. So you want to just keep going and say, did we do this here? Did we do this here? Do we mean non-custodial parent? Is that who we're trying to say comes first? Or are we trying to say the parent needing protection? Who is it that we want to come first or second? Who are these children in this group? And how can we distinguish them? So I'll just stop there on that one, and then I want to bring another situation here. The alcohol one, sample one and sample two. What's getting lumped together there? The category is the category of alcohol and drugs equaling danger. If alcohol equals danger, which it seems to in these two samples, one and two, then we have another term saying if people are under the influence of alcohol or drugs. And I'm going to talk about that a little bit later when we talk about the use of jargon or when we don't define terms properly. Jane's going to talk about that next. And this notion of under the influence of the alcohol or drug is going to go in there. But it's also part of this notion of a category. Alcohol or the use of alcohol, is that what we're talking about? So I want to give an example of, I was at a visitation center a while back, and this guy drops his kids off there. He drops his kids off there, three kids, every Sunday. And then in the winter, he goes about a block and a half down the road, and he watches football at the local bar. And this is, and then he has a beer. And he comes back an hour later, and he's had his beer, and he's watched his little football game at the local bar, and he picks up the kids. So the staff can smell oftentimes that he's had a beer, and we don't know if he's had a beer or two beers or whatever. He doesn't look drunk, but he's now gone off and had a beer while waiting for the kids. What is the policy? How is it directed towards that person? So the staff doesn't do anything about it because they don't ever see him, that he appears drunk or that he can't take care of the kids or anything like that. They wouldn't call the police and say, oh, I think the guy's drunk, because they have no idea how much he's consumed, and he's not acting like he's drunk at all. So when you have a policy like this that says alcohol and drugs are not permitted at the center, meaning you can't bring them in, the bottle or whatever, any clients, staff, or volunteers under the influence of alcohol or drugs may be asked to leave the facility. Now, what does under the influence of alcohol or drugs mean? If a client is under the influence of alcohol or drugs, the staff will decide if further services will be terminated. Local law enforcement may also be notified. So what's the woman to say if she thinks you've got a policy like this and she knows that you know that he went down and had a beer while the kids were there and came back and you didn't do anything about this policy? Because what is the policy actually saying? Is it saying alcohol and drugs are dangerous, therefore any use of alcohol and drugs would be dangerous to children? Because the next policy says that. We believe being under the influence, again, that term, of drugs and alcohol causes everyone's safety to be at risk. So what's this center going to do when the guy comes back and he's had this beer? So what is it that people actually want to say here? It's easy for me to say, oh, look at this, you know, they've done this, but what is it that they're trying to say? So I called the center who had sample two, and I said, okay, we're using, I think this is your policy, and I read it to them, and they said, that sounds like our policy. It's very close to that if it's not. And I said, what are you trying to do when you're doing this? And then they also, their policy is this one of these child refusal policies, the one about if the children arrive alive late, if they don't want to visit once they get to the center. So just talk about this one about if they don't want to visit. And the woman at the visitation center said to me, well, there's, you know, just a lot of reasons that kids come to the center, and they once they get there, they don't want to visit their parents. And I say, okay, and what do you as a center want to do about that? And she said, well, we don't want to pressure them or force them to visit a parent. I mean, that's our bottom line. We don't want to be forcing them or pressuring them into it if they really don't want to. Okay, if that's what's going on and that's what you're saying, then what is it that you're trying to do then? What do you do to not force them, but at the same time not just say, okay, bye, kids, you decided not to visit today? And they said, well, we try to, you know, kind of figure out what's going on with the child. And if there's something we can do to facilitate a visit without forcing them. Okay, so you want to try to facilitate a visit? Is that what I'm hearing? Yes. Okay, so then what if you want to, but the kid still just doesn't want to? Then we don't want to push it. And so then what would you do? And so then they said, well, then we would just write a letter to the court and say we couldn't do it. Okay, so that's the conversation with her. Now, what she's saying is this. I just wrote a policy down that reflects what she was saying. The center recognizes that for a myriad of reasons, a child may arrive at the center and then not want to visit the non-custodial parent. Staff will not pressure or force a child to visit a parent. Staff will make attempts to determine why a child is reluctant to visit and whether or not the center can do something to allow the visit to occur. If a child remains unwilling to visit, the visit will be rescheduled and the staff will talk to both parents about a possible resolution. I want to say why I ended there. So that's a very different policy than the one that you see here, where they're telling the staff people, here, take the kids out, first talk to them, then see if they want to go for the short visit, then do the hello, because those are really specific, very specific. We talked about this last week. Those are way too specific of instructions to use in a policy. Instead, the policy is trying to say what the center is doing. We know there's a lot of reasons why this happens. We're not going to pressure kids. If they don't want to, we are going to try to figure out what's going on. We'll try to facilitate a visit. If that doesn't work, then we'll do this. Now, what are we going to do about it? This thing that you have in this policy, lines 23 to 27, those should be suggestions in an administrative practice, not in a policy. Policy should not get down to ask if they'd like a shortened visit for 10 or 15 minutes. I mean, you're just not going to do that in a lot of cases. So you don't want to put in policy instructions to the staff of how to carry out their task. That belongs in a protocol or a procedure, and we talked about that last week. So you see how this policy is first lumping dissimilar things together, then treating them alike, and then being too specific because they've lumped different things together. Whereas the policy I read to you stays general. We're not going to force people to visit. We'll just try to determine the nature of why the child doesn't want to, see if we can facilitate a visit. If we can't, we're going to reschedule. Now, what are we going to do? When the visitation center says we're going to report it back to the court, that's a real policy question, which is beyond what we're talking about right here. But the question I would have is, why are you going to report this back to the court? Who should the visitation center report to when a child refuses to visit? Should they write it up and give it to each parent? Why would the center automatically be sending this back to the court unless they have an agreement with the parents or the court or the lawyers or somebody that they're going to write reports up and send them off when X, Y, or Z happens? So this idea that you just send it back to the court is also one that you kind of question. That's lumping together all sorts of reasons why visits are going to stop, and then is that the outcome that automatically the visitation center always wants to do, report it back to the court? Now, it may be that you have an agreement with the court that that's what you're going to do if they're court referrals. But remember, these are two independent people using a visitation center in the middle of a court case usually, but many people are not in the middle of this court case. I don't want to say it that way. What I want to say is that to lump together all of these things that you should automatically refer this back to the court is perhaps a questionable practice. And you should ask, who would we send back to the court and why? When would we send the letter actually off to both of their attorneys if they have them? When would we send the letter off to the two parents and let them decide what they're going to do about it, if a parent wants to bring it back to court or not? So then you have to ask the question, why are we going back to the court and lumping all of the resolutions into one place, instead of saying there's different reasons why this would occur, and maybe sending them all back to the court isn't the right thing to do. So basically, this whole notion of thinking about categories is a really, I can just tell you that Jane and I, because we're writing 11 policies, we are thinking of over 100 categories in these 11 policies that are being used. And do we really want to use that category? Do we really want to say, given this, this is what you're going to do? So the categories, this question of what did we just lump together and what assumptions are we making about that, and is that driving then an action that we really want to take every time this occurs? And that's kind of your three questions. And you'll see that it's very helpful to ask those questions as you go along. So I wanted to raise the issue of lumping together children who don't want to visit, lumping together things like alcohol equals danger, lumping together custodial, non-custodial, as if they're similar kinds of groups of people. Those are just three in our sample policies. There's probably more you picked up on, huh, Jane?
Well, a couple that caught my eye were sort of lumping together children and parents
mm-hmm.
who, looking at refusing to visit, sort of those could be very different. In our, again, kind of throwing it all together there and then reporting all that to the court, or in sample one, client, staff, or volunteers. So we're kind of then starting to mix up policy related to the relationship between the center and parents who are using it with volunteers and staff. So kind of
that's a good one. That's a real problem one, is that look at the policy sample one. It says alcohol and drugs are not permitted at the center. Now, I think you should say, you know, I think you should say that staff and volunteers can't come under the influence, but not in the same written policy as what you're going to do with clients who do it, because you have a whole different way that you're going to deal with staff and volunteers who come under the influence. So any client, staff, or volunteers under the influence of alcohol or drugs may be asked to leave the facility. Maybe we're going to ask the staff person to leave. What are you going to do with the staff person? It tells you in this policy what you're going to do with the client, but it doesn't say what you're going to do with the staff person, and you don't want to mix those two together. So have one policy around clients that come in and they're under the influence. I don't even like that term, under the influence, but clients who come in who have been drinking or using drugs, and their behavior then is influenced by it. And then when staff are probably using at all, I mean, the restriction for staff should be probably much more restrictive. Like, staff shouldn't have used any drugs or alcohol before they come to a center. And I think people in these two policies, by using the term under the influence, I think they're not saying that they can't have used, but they can't be exhibiting behavior that shows that they've used. I think that's what that's doing.
I'm going to move us on to flaw three. we're starting to bump up against our Q&A time. And I think flaw three, the policy uses jargon and does not define the terms used. As Ellen mentioned, there, two and three are really closely connected, because it's often the jargon that signals the category. So when we get so familiar in our work world with certain terms, NCP, CP, non-custodial parent, custodial parent, critical incident, facilitator, monitor, that we get very comfortable with, but again, sometimes that can kind of signal the category that we need to be taking a closer look at, as well as looking at how does this relay the idea and what we're trying to get at with this particular policy. One of the words that caught my ear when I was reading through this, it's in, which one is it? It's, oh, on page two. It's sample number three. In talking about children will be transferred from the custodial parent to the non-custodial parent. So that word transferred, you know, what does that carry with it, this kind of notion of a maybe a bit of property that's moved from one place to the other? Is there another way of expressing this role that the center has in accompanying or escorting a child in from one parent to another. And just kind of reading critically with that ear for, is this a word that's going to be readily understood? How is it going to be understood? And is this something that's signaling a category that we want to look at a little closely, more closely at? Same thing with kind of using the building and staff as the means. Something a little, well, is exactly, are we sort of using that as the teleporter? Are we kind of bringing kids in one point from the building and taking them out the end? Kind of stepping back and saying, how do we want to describe our role in making sure that there's no parental contact, and then in making sure that children move from one place to another in a way that's safe and comfortable for them.
You know, Jane, I think even that term, what you used, you don't find in any policies, hardly, that basically the center is designed to make sure there's absolutely no contact between the adults at the center. They don't have a chance to talk to each other. They don't have a chance to see each other. They, you know, and so that's why you have staggered arrival times, and that's why you have separate doors, and that's why you have people in waiting rooms, et cetera. But nobody ever just puts it in the policy. We are designed to make sure there's no contact between the parents. To do that, we do the following. And that then is really easy then to picture, but it's hard for us because we've all seen this so much. We talk about it so much, this staggered arrival and different entrances and exits, all those kind of words jumble up, and what are they saying? If you just say, we're going to make it so you two do not get to see each other, then all those things fall into place for someone. So ask that question. Are you just using this straightforward language that gives the reader a picture of what you're getting at? So
I think one way, too, that you can help catch this is to have somebody read this who's not so steeped in it,
mm-hmm.
that we're making all these assumptions. And maybe part of that, and this might kind of connect a bit with flaw number four, is there an advisory group of parents using the center, or can you take this to a group of women who meet at the local shelter and say, help us read through this. Does this make sense? Are there terms that we don't understand, you don't understand? So kind of thinking about who can be your critical readers as you develop policy is I think, an important point.
And in this next one about fatal flaw four, about being client-centered, there's a couple of things. It's just what Jane is saying, asking people, read this and see if it fits for you, if the policy actually works for you. And that's the notion of having an advisory council, a group of women who have used either a visitation center or who have been separated from a batterer and had to arrange visits, et cetera, even if they didn't use a visitation center. An advisory group like that can be really valuable to a visitation center. Having a group of people, clients who have used it, older children who are not using it anymore but used to, they can all give you really good feedback on these policies and what worked and what didn't work, both in terms of the policy itself and then in terms of how it's written. And then I think the other thing about the client-centered part, because we talked about this last time, so we don't need to talk so much about it, but the policy should read, you know, if we want to put in respect for people, I think the difference between sample one and sample two on the alcohol policy, it's a big difference if you're a person reading it. They're basically are trying to say the same thing. You know what? You don't get to drink here, and if you do, things are going to happen. But sample one says alcohol and drugs are not permitted at the center. Any clients or staff under the influence may be asked to leave the facility. If a client is under the influence of drugs or alcohol, the staff will decide if further services will be terminated. Local law enforcement may also be notified. This is all kind of like this kind of threatening language. The next one says, we believe that being under the influence causes everyone's safety to be at risk. To this end, no one is allowed to be in the visitation center if they're suspected to be under the influence of drugs or alcohol. And then you could put something in there that we reserve the rights to do the following things and list some of them. But this other one is written so just kind of think of the word as, you know, like this, the visitation center is there to help people through a difficult time in life. And it's to recognize that these are difficult times, that not very nice things are going on, and we're here to help people get through this without hurting each other. And if that's the tone of what you're thinking, that tone should come out in the way these things are written. And so your policies can say almost the same thing. They don't have to be wimpy, but they don't have to be so harsh in terms of you will obey, kind of, you know, the way that comes off. At the same time, we don't want to be Pollyannish. You're dealing with batterers. You're dealing with people who have been some people who are very, very dangerous, and people who will push every rule to the max. So I'm not advocating for something that's wimpy or vague. In fact, just the opposite, but something that's not quite so, the tone of it isn't quite so judgmental and harsh, I think.
Well, and do you think, Ellen, that part of it is, and I think this kind of connects with fatal flaw number 5 in being reflecting and being true to the guiding principles, is you have to look at how you build in elements of flexibility to respond to people's unique circumstances and also respond to those distinctions in what do we mean by domestic violence that we talked about earlier.
Mm-hmm. Right, and the last one is going through those 6 principles, and just if you put those 6 principles up against every policy, guarantee you, you'll start rewriting your policies a bit.
Okay, we're going to take a little break for questions. So push the number 1 on your keypad just once, and then Stephanie will be able to get in the question queue. Another option I forgot to mention is if you don't want to answer the question or we move on too quickly before you push number 1, you can email me and I'll get your question in either during this call or afterwards. I'll follow up with you. So my email is beth@praxisinternational.org. So either push 1 or email me and we'll take some questions. Stephanie, has there been anybody who's been waiting for a question to be answered?
There have been no guests waiting. However, we do now have a guest in the queue.
Right.
And our first question does come from Sammy. Your line is open.
Hi, this is Sammy, and I'm calling from Virginia. I just had a statement that you all were, when you were referring to letting like your advisory board read your policies, the problem that I have with that when I first came aboard in this position is it seemed like they wanted me to make them more harsher than what, you know, it was kind of like
let them through that door.
Yeah, because their, you know, their view of batterers was oh, they're so evil and you can't let them do anything. And so now just listening to that and thinking about some of the policies that we still have in place, I can see, you know, that advisory council's influence in that one.
Uh-huh, yeah, right. No, you're right that you,
timing
it's
is everything.
It's why we don't have vigilante justice, isn't it? We don't let the victim decide the punishment of a person because they'll hang them all. So you do want to really pick an advisory board, and you can really be blunt with people. Say, look, we know that, like, if you're dealing with a group of battered women, you have to say, now we're going to be coming from our highest spiritual selves when we do this, and that these are our principles, and that we are here to try to help men get through this period of time without hurting anyone. So this is our commitment is to being clear. It's to being very protective of victims of battering. But at the same time, we're here to try to move these guys in a way that is going to have them do less harm. We're not here. We're not the ones that are going to be punishing them. That's not our role. Our role is to make sure that they don't use us or the kids to continue to batter. And our role is to give access for visits. It's being clear with that advisory group and say, we want you to look at these things, but at the same time, we can't you know, and they'll get that way in a meeting, and then you, I think you just talk about it and say, okay, okay, here we go. We've lost our spiritual principles here. And it'll work. People will come back into line.
Oh, okay. And
does that help at all, Sammy?
We've lost Sammy.
Oh, we've lost Sammy. Okay. One of the things I was going to say is that if people, we do have some time on this call to take a few more questions. So if you've got problems of a particular policies you're trying to think through, this is the time to ask about those.
Our next question does come from Diana. Your line is open.
Yes, hi. This is Diana from Vermont. Actually, a couple of questions. One is, can you repeat, like in one or two sentences, what is available this summer? I didn't have a pen and pad ready.
The two things that are, one thing that's coming up this summer will be this thing called the St. Paul Blueprint. And it is a set of policies in the criminal justice system that from 911 all the way through, but in every one of those policies, it distinguishes between battering cases, reactive violence, and non-battering related domestic violence. It shows you how to build that into policy. It's not in a visitation center, but I think by seeing how it all comes together, it's really something that would be good for your collaborative to look at, to see how the agencies have to merge their policies so that they're working together. And obviously one of the things you want is a collaborative that's giving you what you need to figure out, who am I dealing with here? Am I dealing with a batterer? Am I dealing with somebody who has been battered for 10 years and kicked back? Because all I'm getting is his story and her story, and I can't tell. So you should be able to expect, after you've worked with your collaborative for a long enough time, that you're getting enough information to help make those determinations and setting up your safety procedures then accordingly.
I think it'll also be helpful, too, in illustrating how you ground it, because one of the things we're trying to do is define this sort of common ground or understanding that everyone who's part of, in this case, the collaborative, buys into and understands.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so that's the first one.
And Deanna, I'll take responsibility to you and everybody on the call to get you updated when information is released.
And then the second thing that I mentioned was a piece that's coming out from the National Council on Juvenile Family Court Judges on how to differentiate, how to use these same three categories in family court, and that would be much more tied into the visitation center's kind of way of looking at things. That won't be ready probably for almost a year, but it'll be, when it comes out, it's exactly what visitation centers need as a way of looking at different types of domestic violence and how they influence parenting and the decision by the court of where a child should be and what kind of access they should have to the non-custodial parent.
Oh, that makes sense, and actually that sounds very exciting. Any idea when any of these will be available?
Yeah, a year. The second one will be a year out, and the other one will be out next summer, this coming summer.
This summer?
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay. And so I have one more question, if I may. You know, you're saying that, you know, policies should be written carefully as to not lump, you know, all people together, because we're all individuals with individual situations, and I completely agree. Why are the trainings that are put on by Praxis tend to be set up where, you know, they're for everyone, when people's needs tend to be, not only their needs tend to be different, but also, you know, many centers come from different places. There's a difference if a center comes out of a domestic violence agency or, let's say, the court or DCF or probation, parole or something. And so there's a whole different, you know, belief system that already, you know, training, everything like that, it comes with that. A lot of times the training is like, okay, you know, we're going to talk about this, it's all lumped together, and I'm not sure that it's always Oh, that helpful? Mm-hmm. Not that I'm not suggesting that this isn't helpful.
No, I get what you're saying. So first of all, I want to just say that I'm not saying the first thing you said is that everybody's an individual and you have to treat them all individually. You can't. In order to run any kind of an operation, you have to group events together. What I said is that when you do it, when you create a category, ask yourself, who did we just put together, and are they really the same? Are there differences in who we just lumped together that then, therefore, this policy wouldn't work for everyone? So you have to lump people together. You just can't write policies in which every single individual circumstance is there. You've got to lump. You've got to use categories in any kind of administration of institutions or agencies. But you ask the question of it, who did we just lump together? And if that's who's in this group, does this policy really fit all of those people? And if it doesn't, then you've got to have either two sets of categories or you've got to start to say this isn't the right policy for this group of people. But then secondly, your second question of why do we do what we say you shouldn't do? Because we never have time to read our own advice, I guess, is the answer to that one. Is that you're right, we talk about this all the time, is that how can we differentiate in the level of expertise people have, where they are in the process. So OVW has tried to do that by having TA that's just for people who are just getting funded and they're new grantees. So they get a whole range of TA that people who have been around for a long time don't get. And so as new people are coming in, they get a specialized track of TA, and then everybody else gets lumped together. And I do think that this is an ongoing problem with all of the OVWTA, is that we're bringing together people, and oftentimes you've got someone who this is their first time at a training, other people have had a lot of training, and it's been a really difficult thing for OVW and the TA providers to figure out of how do we adjust to the varying skill levels and what people know about domestic violence and what they know about the particular area of domestic violence they're in. And so I think you've hit on something that we talk about a lot and haven't really solved.
Oh. Thanks, Deanna. Stephanie, do we have any other questions before
Yes, ma'am.
Okay.
Our next question does come from Barbara. Your line is open.
Hi, I'm from Greene County, Ohio, and my question is this. I totally understand when you're developing your policy about, for instance, keeping the parties separate and not maybe making, you know, the custodial parent's going to arrive 5 minutes early and the non-custodial parent, whatever. My question is when we do an intake orientation, procedure is something that clients do need to know. So do you address that in a different, separate
document,
from your
right.
policy?
Yes. You have a document that's called your policy and a document that's called your procedures.
Okay.
Yep.
That answers my question.
And you don't mix the two. Think of it this way. Your board sets your policy or, you know, your board of directors. This is who we as a board of directors want this to be our policy. Your director and the staff and the director should really be setting those, and I shouldn't say this universally because now I'm lumping you all together and you have very different kind of organizations, but basically you generally think of it as that boards set policy and administrators of agencies set protocol and procedure. Protocol and procedure can change a lot. Policy should be kind of fixed and only changed very rarely. Another thing is that policy is what you get sued about. So if you have a policy that says you're going to wand people and you don't wand somebody, goes wrong, you didn't follow your policy. Your procedures are more set of guidelines that you don't want to be quite so absolute directive, where policies are, this is how it's going to be. So you want to protect yourself a little bit by taking things out of policy that you don't intend to do every time.
Okay. So my follow-up question would be then when you do an intake orientation, you would just review the procedures with your with the person who is going through the intake.
Yes. You know, you can decide when you write your policy and your procedures, what do your clients need to know? And you can, you know, like, basically, you really should have eventually work towards a kind of a client's pamphlet of what about the policy is really pertaining to them? Because you have a lot of policy that's really about your staff and other things. But so you that could be for public consumption if people want it, but you really want something that's written more specifically to clients.
Okay.
And one other little thing about this procedure policy breakdown, Jane and I in the policies we're writing a policy. I'm writing the policy on probation, okay? And I'm saying that the probation does a pre-sentence investigation, which is like your orientation. And I say in there that they have to do a pre-sentence investigation within this time period. They have to do this, this, and this. And they use these guidelines to do it, and that's the procedures. So the policy refers to the guidelines, refers to the procedures, and then those procedures can change periodically. But by saying they use the guidelines established by the administration, then those guidelines are the policy until they get changed, but they can change more frequently. Do you know what I mean?
I think so.
Like, you know, it's the PSI form that you use. The probation officer in the policy shall complete a competent completion of the PSI form, and then the name of the form, and then the form is an administrative procedure.
Okay.
So as long as that's the current form, that's really part of policy, but then you can change that frequently.
Okay.
I do think it's one of the areas that requires the greatest amount of kind of chewing over, because it is tempting to want to throw it all in one place. And then you start losing sight of, well, what's the core here? What's really required? And then get locked in a way that you don't have that flexibility, like you said, Ellen, to be able to adjust and tweak the procedure, the putting it into practice piece of it. I'm kind of inclined to say all of our policies should be no more than one page.
Well, you know, our probation policy is there's just 9 policies, you know, and it's those policies refer a lot to either guidelines, attachment forms. And those, by the reference, become a part of the policy, but they're still out there and can be changed and modified more easily.
And I think it's helpful, too, to always keep in our heads that we're really talking about sort of the proverbial three-legged stool. One leg is the policy language. One leg is the procedural support for that the how you make the policy real. And the third thing is the training piece.
Mm-hmm.
To the ways in which everyone comes to know what's in there. Maybe it's a four-legged stool. Maybe the fourth one is then how you communicate to different audiences. So what do parents using the center need to know? Do they need that exact whole policy and procedure document? Probably not.
Oh. And I don't think the parents should have one that says what you're going to do if staff come drinking to the center. I mean, it's not that they can't have access to that if they don't want to sue you because one of your staff people were drunk, but I don't think it's something you pass out. And so you really keep your personnel-type policies separate and things like that. So
we received a couple of email questions, several of them all related to getting approval from OVW for your policies.
Mm-hmm.
And so I think what these messages mean is that people are thinking, we may be needing some work and changing some of our policies, and now what do we do with OVW? So just as a reminder that OVW does need to approve your policies. So if you significantly change them, then they need to know that. So that was the question, several questions asking somewhat of the same thing.
And let me say this, that OVW is not requiring this thing that we're saying right now. Like, I've read a lot of OVW-approved policies that some of these ones that you're seeing right here that we're criticizing are. So you don't have to make this distinction yet in OVW policies, but I think this whole thing that we've just given you It's a training piece that we've developed for OVW on writing policies, and I think they're going to move in this direction in the future. So as you're writing new policies, if you follow a lot of these things we're saying, you're going to be in pretty good shape. They're not going to say to you, oh, my God, look at that. You've got procedures in with your policies. You are dead meat. They're more interested in the content. Are you following the principles, and are you really protective of adult and child victims? That's what they're looking for in their critique of policies right now. They're not going for all these more technical things we're saying of how to lay them out and how to write them accurately. They're trying to get to the core, just the basics right now. Do your policies really protect adult victims and children, give equal regard, et cetera? Would you say that's true, Beth?
Yes.
Yeah, and they might eventually go towards, once they develop kind of a model policy, then you'll be able to see a layout of the policies that's more in line with what we're saying here. So I don't want people to look at your policies and panic, because your policies won't match this thing we're saying. But if they're protective of adults and children victims, if they fit your special conditions, if they go along with the six principles of OVW's thing, then you're going to be in pretty good shape.
Okay, so next up, pull out your materials. Is there's a little two-page checklist that we're going to go through and introduce as a means to also help support your work in examining policies. And we'll take one more break before the end of the call to get any last-minute questions. So, Jane, do you want to go through the worksheet real quickly?
I will, and I'm just going to highlight a bit on this. It's always really helpful to do these calls, because as we're trying to develop all this stuff and we sort of put it out and try it out in different ways, sometimes go, oh, you know, this might need some redesign of its own. And I think this might be one that's maybe a little more intense than it needs to be. But its purpose, this policy check, is to present some ways of looking at, say we've got our draft together, or you've got a policy in place, and you want to step back and say, well, how do we try to make sure that this isn't something that's going to end up being more harmful than helpful, that's going to run counter to those guiding principles that we're trying to make real through the policies that we're developing? So this is an adaptation of some work that Ellen and Coral McDonald did a few years ago around developing policies and protocols. And it's a kind of guide to sitting down, taking a piece of policy, reading it over, and asking, for example, in number one, does this policy anticipate how batterers might circumvent its intent and find ways to use the policy against victims? And asking, well, what do we have here? Is it on track to help our center address the complexities of who people are and their life circumstances and create that opposing experience to battering to provide that equal regard for safety? If not, how might this be a problem? What do we need to look closer at? And my hunch would be, in many cases, it's maybe. We don't quite know yet. And what additional information do we need? So, for example, we've been talking a lot, and some of our policy examples are about this very tight arrival and departure, defining a number of minutes. And then taking a look at how that might work in ways that make it easier, perhaps, for someone who's battering to make use of that. We talked about how that works differently if the visiting parent is actually the person who's being harmed, and how that tight framework around those categories of custodial and non-custodial can make that look very different then if you're...
By that, are you meaning, Jane, like, for example, if you have a kind of hard and fast rule that says if a person is 10 minutes late, such and such will happen, that can be used by a batterer against this woman's bringing the kids in and she's got three kids, she's trying to get them on a bus across town and she's late, that he can say, look, you disobeyed these rules? Is that what you're talking about?
Well, I think that could be one example of it, where that rule then, if it's coupled with, and we always report this information,
mm-hmm.
ends up making her look like the irresponsible parent who's violating the rules of the center, et cetera. But also in who has access to, again, that notion of keeping parents apart and how that can be maneuvered at different times.
Mm-hmm.
Another example on here, kind of bumping down to the second one, and anticipating how it might be used against victims of battering by other interveners. We haven't talked a lot about how information goes out in documentation and reporting. That's another one of those rather giant topics. But kind of going back to our sample policies and this language about children refusing to visit and then this automatic report to the court being made. And again, there's the question of what do you have in place around that collaborative, but how can that also then be used in ways that weren't anticipated and weren't intended. So laying out here a series of questions to ask and explore about policy and is this what we really intend, and how might this not work?
Okay, thanks, Jane. So we're going to take one last bit of questions. At the very end of your agenda, what we did was we did a little wrap-up of the four key phases of policymaking, and it basically wraps up the key elements of our last three calls together to say that these were the things that four things that we pulled out to pay attention to in phases of writing your policy. So hopefully those will help you in just recalling our conversations today and in the last 2 weeks together. So before we end our call, Stephanie, do we have anybody who has burning emergent questions for us?
Not at this time.
All right.
Okay, so as we kind of, as you go away, I want people to kind of think, okay, we have given you lists and charts and, all sorts
numbers
of things to check against. And it's partly because Jane and I are in the midst of doing this massive policy thing right now, and all of these things are what we're trying to tell ourselves. So I just want to give out a word of sympathy to everyone, is that I realize that writing these things, don't make it into a chore. Just think you've got time. It's not like, you've got to rewrite all your policies instantly. But if you can just kind of take a segment at a time and start working on them to get them to be more precisely what you want and more reflective of who you are, what your principles are, and things like that. And I think you shouldn't just try to take on the whole thing all at once, but just kind of take an area of policy development, work on it, and then move on to another area. And I do think that you're getting a lot of good advice from us on how to do it. You're not getting any good samples. And so that's something that we will talk to OVW about. We just need to have at least four, like a policy on child refusal or a policy on, if we just were to pick three or four policy areas and write really good model policies on that, I think it would be a huge impact on everyone. Okay, that's how you put all this together in one policy. So I think we will definitely talk to OVW about getting something like that out sometime in the next, I'm not even going to say how long.
Well, don't put a time frame on that.
Yeah.
But also to say, as a result of these calls, I've been getting a lot of calls from grantees to ask for some specific help and talk through and brainstorm together And I have been working with a number of development grantees on their entire policy and getting ready to submit and open their doors. So I just wanted to remind everyone on the call that you're not alone. That's the purpose of TA is to be here to support you. So you can contact me at any time. I can either help you or I can get you hooked up with a good resource. I can get you some things to think about, or we can just spend some time talking. So contact me anytime, and to know that this is a daunting task and it feels very overwhelming. And we know that, and we're here to support you. So please do use technical assistance as often as you want. I'm here, and I'll support you in any way I can. So
thank you very much, Beth, for putting this on. It was, you know, that nice big three times in a row we really got to say about everything there is to say here. So thank you very much.
Certainly got us thinking.
It did get us thinking, and so I really want to express my sincere thanks to Ellen and Jane for taking time out of their incredibly busy schedules to do this with us. We really appreciate it. We appreciate your intelligence and your smartness around all of this, so thank you for doing that. And thank you to all of you who take time out of your day to listen to all of these calls on an ongoing way, and thank you for putting in your feedback. As you can tell, we really tried to use it, so continue to give us your feedback in the evaluation you'll get. We are planning on our next, not a training series, but we'll have a Visitations Things discussion, which means it's just an open dialogue, an hour and 15 minutes of examining something that is an emergent issue. April 16th is the next time that we'll come to do that, and we're going to talk about intervening in supervised visitation. So look for publicity. It will come in the next couple of weeks to you, and that will be the next time that we can join all of us together on an audio call. So with that, I say goodbye to everyone, and thanks for joining the call.
Thanks, everyone.
Thanks, Jane.